Good afternoon. So, last time we kind of recorded lecture because of a sort of last minute snow cancellation. I maybe should try to do things via Zoom, though I'm not really happy trying to do that on 20 minutes notice and think I would have no one come via Zoom. So we reviewed, because on the exercise on Monday, we kind of went over very briefly, and it was definitely based on the response, seemed confusing to people, kind of talking about, like, having this case where we could set integers that overlap with the bytes of our return address and thinking about how that corresponds. And I wanted to emphasize that because this issue is going to come up a whole bunch of times later in the class. In fact, we have a value of one type that we know is going to be reinterpreted as another type. So in the example we had on Wednesday and Monday, it was an array of integers that was going to be reinterpreted as, in part, a pointer. And we're going to see this pattern over and over again. A lot of memory exploits, especially memory exploits that work in spite of things like stack canaries and shadow stacks and things like that, are based on this idea that we're going to have one thing that gets interpreted in a different way by the program somehow. Then we talked about kind of the big enemy of stack canaries and also an enemy of some mitigation techniques we'll talk about in more detail later, like randomizing like the start location of the stack and things like that, which is information leaks. That the same code that has buffer overflows is likely to also sort of print out values that aren't supposed to be printed out. One way this can happen is uninitialized variables. If we have an uninitialized variable on the stack, well, what was previously on the stack is probably what's going to be in it, the way most compilers work. You can also have buffer overflows where we don't have a write overflow, we have a read overflow. And that's kind of still useful to an attacker for things like stack canaries, because if we overflow into the stack canary, now we know what to put in our normal buffer overflow to do stack smashing and kind of work around the stack canary being checked. Well, we just put the same value there, it's going to match. And we also have a pattern that we're going to see, talk about the write version of, where we can have overflows that modify some sort of pointer or something that acts like a pointer, like an array index. And this ends up letting us kind of read arbitrary places in memory. And we called this kind of a read gadget. So this is common term we'll see again later this semester of gadgets, which are like kind of pieces of code in a program that an attacker can use to assemble their malicious execution. So we can have these read gadgets that, especially in something like a server, which accepts many, many requests, we can kind of use these read gadgets multiple times, combine them with other things we find in the program to do something that the program is really not supposed to let us do, really not designed to let us do. And as our main topic today, we're going to talk about write gadgets. So read gadgets let us read somewhere random in memory. Write gadgets let us write somewhere random in memory. And we're going to talk about how we can use those, what they look, how they happen by accident in programs. You know, and that's going to be our main topic, and that's what we're going to call pointer subterfuge, which is also the assignment after next week. Before we did that, we talked a bit about this idea of shadow stack. So stack canaries had this idea that we just put some, value before our return address, and because most buffer overflows are contiguous, it would end up being written in most buffer overflows, and as long as we kept it secret, wasn't a problem. But we saw that this was, you know, maybe not the most effective approach, especially when we have information leaks. So there's this alternate idea called shadow stacks, where we have two stacks. We have one stack, which is only storing things like return addresses or other sensitive information. And either we do our returns using that shadow stack, so that's where the return address is, and it's not anywhere close to the stuff that we input, our buffers on the stack and the local variables, or we kind of store two copies of each return address and we double check them before returning. And kind of the key advantage of shadow stacks over stack canaries is that we can try to keep the location of the shadow stack a secret you know, or at least very hard to figure out, and that's going to be better than our stack canaries, which, because they're on the stack next to all normal program data that deals with user input and output, is much more likely to kind of leak out. And we talked briefly about sort of Intel's design for hardware-assisted shadow stacks, where we have even extra hardware support where, like, normal move instructions wouldn't be allowed to read or write from the shadow stack, which would make it, you know, hopefully really hard for someone to do something like our stack smashing attack. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So some notes on obfuscate. So one thing is, as mentioned, that I said an announcement that I wrote the wrong GDB command. I think I was looking at the LDB commands and got confused in the assignment, which some people noticed, some people didn't. Maybe there's multiple sources for commands. The other thing is, a lot of people have loaded the memory dump into Cohedra, as we mentioned you can do, and the assignment does not mention that as a technique for writing a new executable. And the reason why is that Cohedra keeps track of where data comes from. So when you exit to export an executable in the original format, it will say, gosh, these bytes, they came from .bin. I'm not going to write them to the .exe file. There might be a way of fixing that, working around that. My suggestion in the assignment, and the only thing I know how to reliably do, is do something like what you did in Tricky, where you just modify the executable directly. You've learned from doing Tricky how to modify a particular part of the machine code. And you can use that technique again. I guess other notes are, as I mentioned in the prior announcement, yes, there is a bug in the game where I got an array, a loop bound wrong, and the tie checking is broken. I'll fix that next semester, but I didn't want to change the binaries. So we consider it working and inputting the numbers working, because that's the only thing you're likely to break by accident. Okay, any other obfuscate questions? No. Satisfied. Okay, and on other assignments, next week's assignment is over. The slide link in the assignment was bad. It should not be bad anymore, though you could have found the slides some other places too. And that's doing stack smashing. So this is the stack smashing assignment, and that is due next week. And there's some pretty detailed advice in the assignment, including regarding some issues that may be not intuitive that come up in that the stack smashing attack. So one issue that is mentioned is that when your shell code is running, the stack pointer can point in the middle of your shell code because it's on the stack. So the way to work around that is just to move the stack pointer somewhere deliberately not over your shell code. If you don't do that, then push will modify your shell code, and that could be non-intuitive and really hard to debug. That's why it's mentioned in the assignment. The other thing that comes up is that the x86-64 calling convention says that the stack pointer needs to be a multiple of 16 when the call instruction is run, meaning that the function should start with a stack pointer at a multiple of 16 minus 8. And there's some functions, including printf on current versions of Linux, that might crash if you don't do this. So that's mentioned in the assignment, but that's something that's not intuitive to debug, that detail about the calling convention. And regarding this week, I am gone Wednesday afternoon through Friday. My current plan is I will teach on Wednesday and then immediately drive to Pittsburgh. And Brad Campbell will teach on Friday. So questions on over? Okay, so our main topic is going to be about what we call pointer centrifuge. So here we have a buffer overflow that overflows a pointer. And our assumption is that this is going to be laid out such that the buffer is before in-memory pointer invalid. And given that, this is what we might call a write gadget. This lets us write an arbitrary value to an arbitrary memory address. So as an example, if this is our layout, we can fill up our buffer, and we can set this so that we overwrite this part, thereby setting the pointer and the value. And one application of this is that we can just evade stack canaries. We can figure out the address of the return address, set that to pointer, set val to be the address at the beginning of the buffer, or the middle of the buffer, address of our shellcode. And when the code does its assignment of doing, in this case, star pointer equals val, it's going to modify the return address for us. And because it's modifying the return address, you know, with that pointer, it never modifies the stack canary. The stack canary does nothing. Questions about this idea of sort of using our buffer overflow that modifies a pointer to write a value into the return address. So this is something we can do. This probably seems really annoying to do, primarily because to execute this attack, we need to precisely figure out the address of the return address. Whereas we were talking about doing things like nop sleds to not need to precisely know where the stack is. Here, it seems like we need to know exactly where the stack is. So while this is an option for taking advantage of this write gadget, this is by far not the easiest way of doing it. So we talked about, so I guess let's talk about like things we can do given that we have a write gadget like this. So one option is that we could just actually, instead of making a pointer to code, we could just, you know, set the pointer to point to existing machine code and replace it with our own machine code. The reason that this is typically not something we'll discuss is that in most sort of modern systems, our memory is not marked as executable and writable at the same time, which is something we'll talk about later. Obviously, that for the stack smashing attack, that wasn't true for the stack, but there's usually not machine code there. But our typical places we load normal code from on a desktop or laptop or mobile phone won't be writable. But on some other systems, this might not be so true. Like, for example, it's probably pretty common for like very constrained embedded systems to have all the memory with code just be writable all the time, in which case that's probably more straightforward than overwriting a return address. You just modify a function that's going to run directly. We can overwrite the return address like we showed. So that is an option, but we can kind of do, but we're going to talk about options to do better than that. We could overwrite some other function pointer, and you might say, well, this sounds very application-specific. And it certainly is more application-specific than stack smashing, but there's a lot of common patterns where there's exposed function pointers in programs that are easy to locate and easy to modify. Another option is we can kind of chain these sort of little tools for making the program do things together. So if we have this kind of tool to write some memory, we can maybe use it to modify some other pointer and have the program like copy a whole bunch of stuff by telling it to copy to the wrong place. So we can, you know, turn a small memory write into like some larger sequence of stuff without directly executing machine code from it. So, let's talk about an example of this idea of overwriting a return address. So here I have some code where we have the pattern we had before. We have a pointer to an array, and then we have a buffer overflow. And the layout on the stack, we can figure out from this assembly here. So initially, our stack pointer, is here, and we have our return address above there. And then we do this subtract 136. So this is the initial stack pointer minus 136. And then at 120 plus that, so one at minus 16 minus the original stack pointer, here, we place the canary. And then we call allocate with a pointer to array, which is at 104 minus the original stack pointer. And I guess for convenience, I will number these from the new stack pointer. So this will call 0, this will call 120, this will call 136. So that's just the offset from the subtracted stack pointer, just because that's going to be easiest to read from the assembly for me. And so at 104 here, offset, we have the pointer array. That's passed to allocate. And then we pass to get us buffer, and so buffer must be at offset 0 because RDI is set to just the stack pointer without any change before get us is called. So we have buffer, which is 100 bytes here. So this is our stack layout. We have the buffer, we have a 4 byte gap, we have the array, we have the stack canary sometime after that, and then we have a return address. So my question is, if the return address is an address 12345, I'm going to use this to overwrite the return address, this buffer overflow. Where should I place 12345 and in what format? Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the answer should be. Would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, G? Okay. So, guess I did not explain what was going on here well. So what you propose, what the plurality proposed doing is F. So if we're thinking about what happens if we do scenario F, we're gonna have our write 100 over 136 bytes. So that means that we're going to start writing buffer here from the F get us, and we're gonna overwrite all the way to the return address. And the problem is that we have overwritten the stack canary by doing that. So that's the first problem. Secondly, if we're going to overwrite the return address this way, we don't need to place the value, the return address address, the location of the return address, which we're told is, you know, we're basically told that this is equal to address 12345. That's where the return address is. We don't need to write that address anywhere. We just would overflow it directly. The reason we aren't going to overflow it directly here is because if we do a simple buffer overflow, we overwrite the stack canary, and the return won't actually return. It will check the stack canary and crash. So we can't overwrite the return address given the stack canary by just directly writing it, even though, yeah, we can, I guess, let me rephrase that. We can overwrite the return address, we can't usefully overwrite it by directly overflowing the buffer. So yes, you all figured out, oh, that's where the return address is, that's what we want to overwrite. And for the stack smashing assignment, we've disabled stack canary, so that works great. But this code has a stack canary. So that's not going to work so great, unless we know what the value of the stack canary is. So if we know what the value of the stack canary is, we can make that work. But we don't. So instead, we're going to use this kind of pattern. There's a pointer on the stack that we want to be used to overwrite the stack canary. So not the stack canary, to overwrite the return address. And kind of our goal here is that after the fgets, this pointer is in fact used here. And it's dereferenced and set to a value that's based on the number, what string we input. So our goal here is going to be that we're gonna, since we can't, unless we learn the stack canary somehow, overwrite the stack canary directly, overwrite this stack return address correctly because we would overwrite the stack canary, we're going to set things up so that when that array index 0 equals a to I of buffer runs, that array index of 0 is the return address. Questions on how this, sort of what we're trying to do with overwriting pointers? So to make this work, we're going to avoid overwriting the stack canary at all. We don't want to touch it. And instead, we're going to overwrite to modify the pointer array. And we want the pointer array to point to the return address. And if the return address is at 12345, we want to make array be equal to the number x12345. And so that gives us D, because we learned the array was located 104 bytes after the beginning of the buffer. And it's going to be kind of as the raw bytes of the pointer, because that's fgets. The way fgets works, or gets works, is that it reads a character from standard in, sees if it's a new line, if not, copies it to the buffer, and does that in a loop. And our character is a byte, so it copies bytes from standard into the buffer in a loop. And when it does that, it doesn't know how long the buffer is, so it keeps going until past the end. So questions? Yes?
So we modify the pointer to point to the return address, and the following bytes is the address that we want to jump to?
Question, we modify the pointer to point to the return address, and where do we put the address we want to jump to? That is the next slide's exercise. But the key thing to keep in mind, so we'll talk about that explicitly next, but the key thing to keep in mind is that array 0 equals HUI buffer, that's what's actually using the pointer we modified. So our goal is going to be to make that set the return address to the value we want. So that makes sense. Other questions? So we'll hopefully clear up by doing the exercise of like, okay, so now we've set up our buffer. So our input is, I guess I should say, input is going to be something that's 104 bytes, followed by 0x12345, followed by a new line. That's going to be our input. And we learned that this 0x12345, this is sort of as the bytes of an 8-byte number, because that's the format pointers are in memory. Where do we put the value we want to be assigned to that return address? So check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what. Like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer should be A, B, C, D, E, F, G, then none of these? Okay, so we have a split between A and B. So what's going to happen, and maybe it's easier to illustrate with our assembly code here, is after getS is called, we're going to run the code for this statement here, which is this. This is the assembly code for that line. So A2I, if you look it up, is a function that converts an ASCII number to an integer and expects a base 10 number. So that's why the answer is A. So we're taking our base 10 number at the beginning of the buffer, and we're assigning it to array of 0. And this code implements that by loading arrays into RBP, the value of the pointer. Then it sets up a call to string to L, which is used to implement HI, so it converts a string to a long. And you can see it's passing the buffer as the first argument, 0 and 10. If you look up string to L, 10 is the base to use. 0 is the place to point where we stop seeing a number. The way HY and string to L work, if the whole thing isn't a number, if the beginning is a number, it gives you that number. Yeah?
So what can we put in the buffer so that HY stops reading at the end of the number, but getS keeps reading all the way to the override?
So the question, what do we put in the buffer so HY stops reading at the end of the number and getS doesn't? So conveniently for us, the way HY and string to L work is they stop reading when the stops being a characters for a number. So we don't have to do anything special. We can just put space. If things were more picky, we could do something like we could put a value followed by a null character since getS accepts those, but we don't even need to do that. We could just put like a space or an A or whatever because of the way HY works. Is it doesn't like check if it's not a number, it just gives you a number from the beginning. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's our pointer subterfuge pattern. I'm glad I had out of that exercise, which wasn't in the previous version of the slide deck, because we're going to talk about it a bunch. And you can see, as this is trying to illustrate, like there's often multiple ways that this manifests and that often changes the details. Like in this case, you know, like how we specify the value to overwrite with, you know, is based on what our code here did. So something you might notice is that in order for this to work, we really needed it to be the case that the array pointer was after the buffer, and our compiler didn't need to do this for us. And something that's pretty reasonable for compilers to do is to lay out arrays on the stack and other things on the stack after other variables to make this attack less likely for just random stack variables. You can imagine that happening for other examples. And this does seem to be a thing a bunch of compilers try to do, maybe not consistently, but they seem to try to organize the stack this way. That isn't always an option for compilers, however, because we can have the same pattern with things like structs. So here I have a struct, and the way structs work in C is they have to be in the order we write them. So in this case, we've told the compiler that after values has to be the active values value pointer. It has to be in that order. So we're guaranteed if we have a buffer overflow on values, it overwrites active value. So questions? And another sort of common way this can happen is with global variables. That typically the way global variables work is that they're just put all together somewhere, you know, after the code in the program's memory. And if we have a pointer there and a buffer, something's after the buffer, often it will be the pointer. There's usually not any kind of special order to the way these are laid out. Like it might be based on like what files were combined in what order by the linker. So that's this pattern that comes up a whole bunch where we overwrite a pointer, and that lets us kind of, you know, use that overwritten pointer to have the program access some other things for us, most notably write some other things for us. So in this example, right, we, you know, hypothetically, if getNext used input buffer and didn't check its bounds, right, we could overwrite current command somewhere, or we could, in some previous iteration, yeah, I guess maybe not getNext, but something overwrote current command when this function runs. It's going to use the current value of current command and, you know, access something it shouldn't, maybe write something it shouldn't, based on assuming it's a command just like we saw previously, things overwriting things based on this unit, like it's an array of integers or array of longs. So let's get to kind of the biggest practical issue with this pattern is like, what do we overwrite? And I showed an example, because we learned stack smashing, of overwriting return addresses. But I mentioned return address, it's really tricky to practically locate it exactly. It's not impossible, definitely a thing we can do, but it's not the easiest way to do this attack. And also, we've learned that there are innovations like shadow stacks, which are going to make it not just tricky, but really, really hard, or maybe even not possible to overwrite the return address. So how do we deal with those? Well, there are much easier options, regardless of other mitigations. And the key thing we're going to take advantage of is that kind of normal code uses function pointers all the time. And these function pointers are things we can overwrite to point to a new function, which is our own code. So as an example, let's take our initial case where we had a pointer and a value we were overwriting. And let's remember our global offset table. So if you remember when we talked about dynamic linking, we had these PLT routines, routines we called stubs, that basically kind of called the based on this global offset table. So they looked up an entry in the global offset table, called the address that that pointed to. Actually jumped, but because printf was already called, we don't need to call twice. PLT was already called, we don't need to call twice, so jumped to that location. And we also mentioned that sometimes we actually set these up at runtime, after the program starts even. You have that lazy dynamic binding trick. So given that, we can set our pointer, the thing that we're gonna, in this example, we had the code after we overflow our buffer is running star pointer equals val. So you make star pointer be the global offset table entry for printf. Then we set val to point to our buffer, which, like in stack smashing, contains some shellcode. Then, sometime later, the program calls printf. Now it runs a shellcode. And yeah, we don't have to find any return address. And in many of our programs we've looked at, the global offset table is at a well-known, or at least easier to discover location. So we can much more easily find how to set pointer than we can find how to set pointer to point to the return address. So we end up making our printf call actually call our shellcode. So questions how this idea works? Yeah? Are we overwriting the global offset table or the pointer value? So this is kind of a two-phase overwrite, right? So first, we're inputting into our buffer. In this example, we're inputting our shellcode followed by the address of the shellcode followed by the address of the global offset table entry. And then the code that runs after we do that overwrite uses the pointer we overwrote, dereferences it, and modifies the global offset table. Does that answer your question? So I think which confuses people about this is that there's a series of wrong memory accesses that we're deliberately setting up. We're taking one mistake in the program and making it so the program makes a few extra mistakes afterwards by how we use that first mistake, which was not checking the bounds in the buffer.
Yeah.
Other questions? Yeah.
Do we eventually go back and change the global offset table back to its original values?
Do we eventually go back and change the global offset table to its original values? I would say the typical way you run this attack is, I guess, if you've taken CSO2, you may know that the Unix-like systems, the primary way to run a program is exec. The most common form of this attack, you probably exec something, and then the current process would not exist anymore, and that's irrelevant. If you weren't doing that, you'd probably crash or exit after you did your work. And if it's the sort of program where it has these sorts of bugs in it, it crashing might not stand out. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is one attractive candidate. And when we talk later about kind of memory protection, we will talk a little about kind of the obvious solution to this, which is maybe the global offset table shouldn't be writable like this. There's another common place where we have a target for this, and that's that there's a common pattern in programming where the implementation uses function pointers all the time. And I'm mentioning this because, like, if you look at typical code for typical applications, right, you don't see function pointers being used. Not never, but it's pretty uncommon. But something that is pretty common is using inheritance. So I'm going to show you C++ here because C++ is a language that actually compiles to assembly where people use inheritance all the time. And unlike in prior iterations of this course, 2150 no longer exists, so we no longer actually teach you basic C++. So I'm going to have to go over a few little things that are going on here. For the most part, you can kind of figure it out by assuming it's Java, but there's a few things which are a little weird. So one thing that's a little weird is you might say, what does this virtual mean? So in C++, you have to annotate methods you want to use polymorphic dispatch. So if a method isn't virtual, when you call it, you'll only call the version for the class you're calling it on. It won't dynamically choose based on what subclass it actually is. So using virtual here says, when we call get on an input stream, don't call the input stream's get, call the get for whatever subclass of input stream it is. In Java, this is just the default, which is probably the better choice, but C++ was designed before people thought about this carefully. For some reason, which it's funny because C++ was designed after Smalltalk, which didn't have this problem. But in Java, kind of not writing virtual would be equivalent to writing final in Java, basically. We also have this =0. This is a way of indicating this is an abstract method in C++, just like the abstract keyword in Java. So here I am, and oh. And the other thing I should mention is that this colon is basically extends. I would say this colon public is basically extends. You might ask, why did we write public there? What happens if you don't write public? So C++ has a notion of private or protected inheritance, which I'm just going to mention exists, and you shouldn't use it. So anyways, we have what might look like kind of a Java IO library here, where we have like a get, tell, seek method for dealing with the file. And obviously, there might be multiple different subclasses of input stream and seekable input stream. And we need some way, when we have some code that gets a pointer to a seekable input stream, that it figures out how to actually call the appropriate get or seek or tell method. And the method that the C++ implementation is, and most implementations of similar languages that compile to assembly use, is something called vtables, or sometimes virtual function tables. So this means that we set up kind of our layout for the input stream, SQL input stream, and file input stream object. So they all start with this special pointer to a vtable, and that contains slots for each function, each method we might call of the object, where we have to figure out which version of the method to call. And this is set up so that we can take a file input stream pointer and pretend it's an input stream pointer and everything works. Because everything we do to find the get method with the input stream pointer also works in a file input stream because we set this up in memory. So like there's a pointer in the same place, the pointer to the get function is in the same place, and so on. And the vtable basically ends up pointing to an array of method pointers. So these are this here. This is an array of function pointers. Okay, some questions? This idea. And so kind of our implementation is that like something like what's happening is that if we think of like kind of pseudo C, our input stream basically starts with this vtable, and code that uses an input stream via a pointer is going to dereference the input stream, dereference the vtable, get the get pointer and call using that. And by convention, and usually the calling convention for C++ methods is that their first argument is the this pointer. And otherwise they're called like a C function essentially. And kind of on our object construction side, when we make a file input stream and turn it into an input stream pointer, we make this file input stream object, which where we make sure there's a vtable pointer at the beginning, which is compatible with that input stream layout, and then we just convert the pointer from one type to the other. And we have this vfile input stream vtable, and that's typically kind of a global variable that's set up just statically initialized. So questions? Out. And to be kind of more concrete, so this is an example like of what your compiler would produce. So here I have my SQL input stream I call in and get. And you see for get, we get our in object from the stack in this case. We extract the vtable from it, dereference the first thing in the vtable, vtable 0, call there, to call seek. We again get our vtable, we set up the other arguments, extract the vtable pointer, and get the second thing from the vtable and call it. And if you look at how the C compiler set this up, it's like similar to what we saw. This is the constructor for file input stream. Yes, it's really named that, underscore Z15. The C++ compiler does this funny encode thing to encode C++ names as C names, and you can't put a colon in a label, so this is what they do. But this is the constructor, and you can see it puts the vtable pointer in the this object, at the beginning of the this object, and the vtable pointer is this, and there's also some information before it for implementing something called type ID. Which is basically the equivalent of like the dot class operator in Java. Okay, so next time we'll talk a little about kind of attacking vtables, because this is kind of one of in practical code, especially since like Chrome and Firefox were originally written in C++ and a lot of other important software. This is often sort of the route what you'd use to attack code. And typically, we're not going to overwrite the vtable directly because often it will be in read-only memory. But what we can do is we can create our own vtable pointer and overwrite the vtable pointer to say, this is not a file input stream vtable, this is a malicious my subclass input stream vtable. Where the get method is my shellcode and the seek method is my shellcode, and that's what an attacker will do. So we have some extra indirection, which makes this a little confusing. We'll talk about that next time. So that's where I'll finish up today.
Nothing you want to say.